My name is Michael Klein, and today is November 4th. We're in the trustees' room of the Concord Free Public Library. It's a heavenly day outside. Looks like it may go into the low 70s today. And we're thrilled to be back here in town. And we have a very special guest with us here. Would you introduce yourself, please? Say my name is.
My name is Barbara Kroll Wheeler.
And we never ask people their ages, but maybe you tell us your date of birth.
It's 8/10/31, and I'm just about 84 now, and I've lived here since 1954 when my family moved here from Winchester, Mass. Not far away, but they came here.
Okay.
So I've been here a long time.
Tell us about your people and the details of where you were raised.
Well, I was raised in Winchester, Mass., and my family came here because my father's side had a grandmother who was a Wheeler, and then so he had some distant relatives that lived here. So I have Wheelers on both sides because when I came, there was a nice gentleman who was building a house with his family across the street. So in a sense, I married the boy next door. So everybody loves that story. So,
how does the story go again?
Well, I moved here with my family when I was about 21 or 2, and the Wheelers were building a house across the street, and they had a son who I married, who later, almost about a year and a half later, so I married literally the boy next door, Harvey Wheeler. And Harvey Wheeler is a famous name in this town because his grandfather, Harvey Wheeler, has a school named after him. It's called the Harvey Wheeler School, which is in West Concord. And it's become quite a landmark. It is now the center for a senior center. It's called the Council on Aging, and the other half of it is a daycare center. And it still goes on under his name, the Harvey Wheeler Center. And I married the second Harvey Wheeler.
Grandson.
Yes. They skip a generation. They don't believe in juniors. So it went Harvey Wheeler, Berkeley Wheeler, who was his father, and then my husband, Harvey Wheeler. So I've lived here ever since I moved in the 50s. Yeah.
Would you be willing to talk a little bit about your courtship and getting started together in a new place?
Well, this is a story that everybody loves. My family, as I said, were moving here and they were purchasing this home. And the Wheelers were building a house across the street and had rented this home that my family were buying. My mother knew Mrs. Wheeler a little bit from a summer arrangement once upon a time. And I had just returned from the great trip through Europe after college, which one takes, you know, with your friends. And so mother had moved there, had purchased there, said, "Barbara, come on out. We got to go see this house. Mrs. Wheeler will be there, and you come along with me, and we'll see the house that we're buying. They will be moving out shortly." So off I go with my mother. Then, as I said, I had just turned 21, I believe. And I was wandering around the house while Mrs. Wheeler and my mother were having tea in the living room. And I went into the dining room, and I was looking around. It was a lovely old house with authentic paneling and all that. And the door opened into the dining room, and this tall, handsome man walked in and said, "Oh, what are you doing here?" And that was my reaction. "Oh, yes, what are you doing here?" So that's how we met, in the dining room of a house we were about to purchase. And so then later they moved across the street, and that's the boy next door that I later married about a year later. So that was the beginning of a great courtship.
And that place was located?
That place was located on Musketaquid Road in Concord. That's the road where the two houses were.
Mm-hmm. Spell that, please.
Spell that, please?
Musketaquid.
M-U-S-K-E-T-A-Q-U-I-D, Musketaquid. It's an Indian name. It means meeting of the waters where the Concord River meets the Assabet River, which is, if you drive out of town, you can locate it. Going up, actually, you can see where the waters meet if you drive right out here by the Colonial Inn and take the bridge over onto Lowell Road. And you look to your left, and there is the meeting of the rivers, which was called Musketaquid by the Indians who were previously settled in Concord, way back before we were here, of course. Yeah.
And the Wheeler family must have been one of the very, very early families to come.
Yes, they are. They're the earliest settlers.
Are you descended from those same Wheelers?
Yes. I have to be very careful looking over any documents that are left by the family, because Leslie Wilson in collections, of course, covets anything that I come up with that is pertinent to the past and their legacy. I have brought in many papers here. One thing I do like to mention is that one of the relatives, the Harvey Wheeler grandfather that I mentioned, had a brother named William Wheeler. And he became very famous in Japan. He went to Japan in 1876 to help establish the northern island of Hokkaido, which had just opened up after Japan was opened up in the 1870s. You know, Japan had been an unknown and closed nation until it was opened up by, what's his name? Can't think of it. So just to continue, a bunch of us formed a committee to resurrect all the information and history about William Wheeler, because he was more famous in Japan than he was in Concord, Mass., and he was the founder of this huge University of Hokkaido in Japan, and so we made a forum. I just picked up the other day an article about, we called ourselves a Hokkaido pioneer, because he was an American pioneer who was sent to Japan because they had exactly the same climate on the same latitude as Concord. So he, being an agriculturalist and a graduate of Mass Agricultural School, was able to easily figure out their needs in agriculture in Japan. And so we brought a lot of attention to him. This was about 4 years ago, and we now have a sister city in Japan called Nanai,
and
N-A-N-A-E, I believe. N-A-N-A-E, yes, correct.
Good for you.
Yeah.
So you said they sent William. Who were you referring to exactly?
The Nanai government, the government that was in I shouldn't say power, that they were looking for help to help resettle and colonize this northern island. And I guess they knew that they had been missing out in all the many years that they were a closed nation. They were missing out on science and medicine and education of all kinds, and they were paying to get people on staff to come to the island to help them out. And he was selected from Massachusetts Agricultural School, of which he was a graduate and a young man, not married, and full of energy and optimism to do this great, huge trip to go out there. It was a big deal then, of course, to get to Japan. Yeah, which was a newly opened up nation. I'm digressing from Concord, but
no,
he was. This was a big project of mine and others, few years ago. And I brought this article to mind when I saw it the other day.
Is this for Leslie to look at as well?
Oh, no, she knows all about it.
Oh, she knows
she has all the information.
She has that article?
She has piles of
stuff
and documents, and I gave her all the pictures that he took. He didn't take, but he had taken a lot of photographs by a professional photographer who came along and was hired. And so we have 1870s, very, very early photography that he was keen on establishing. And I found this little tiny album up in the attic of the Wheelers, and we blew them up and made an exhibit of them, and the originals are now with her in the special collections, along with a lot of information on him. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's great, though, to hear you talk, sort of tell the story anyway, because we're always looking for the audio option as well as
mm-hmm.
what's on paper.
Yeah, well, this is...
Talk about his stint of service there. How long was he there?
He was there 4 years. It took a couple of months almost to get there. You'd take the train across to the West Coast, and then in San Francisco you'd get on a boat, and we have his diaries on the boat. That took another couple of weeks, and they got caught in a hurricane the first time he went out, and then you go to Tokyo, and then you have to get another boat to go up to Hokkaido, which if you look on a map, it's the northernmost island in the grouping of Japan's islands. And so when he got there, he formed this school, and the Japanese had to speak English to come to it, so it was a small class, the first class, and they had to learn English. He hardly spoke Japanese, apparently, in his career there. But the island was nothing. It was like the Wild West. And so he established this school, which later has become the Sapporo College there. It's like our BU, you know, with thousands of students. And when I went there, finally, they have kept his original corner of the campus, which is established sort of like our Sturbridge Village that we have, you know, like a colonial restored area. And it shows his barn is there and his buildings and his things that he initially was teaching people, agricultural prowess, I should say, and how to establish agriculture in this wasteland up there. And he began farming there, and he established a cement factory so that they could build buildings, and established a brewery. He established all kinds of things beside this college. And so he's considered a great hero there, and he's been rather unknown here. I think since our forum has stopped, people have already forgotten about him, but I haven't. Yeah, because it's fun to talk about him. I'm sure all the other people you interview talk a lot about Concord, but here's another side of the town.
Oh, it's fascinating.
This man who was brought up here and worked on a farm here that took his knowledge to greater heights. It's wonderful.
That's fascinating.
It is. It really is.
Did he write or leave stories about the
yes.
nature of the people that he found
yes.
there?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have his letters that he wrote home to Mom that are all a person over in Concord Academy here and has transcribed them in on a typewriter, early typewriting. And, it's about 50, 60 pages of her letters, his letters to her, his mother. And he would document all of that he was doing through that. To the letters.
And her name?
Annie Wheeler.
So he would write in some detail about the indigenous
yes.
population.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, because they were his friends. They were like our Indians that lived up. They called Ainus. Have you Ever heard of the Ainus in northern Sapporo? There were, like our Indians who, and they're still bitter and kind of angry about the way they were treated because they were hunter-gatherers, and this new civilization didn't accommodate that very well, just like our pushing out into the West and putting aside our own American Indians. Same story exactly. Mm. Mm.
But had he been going on before but they were, he arrived?
Oh, yes, and they were his friends and guides, and they told him all about the countryside, and of course he befriended them and knew their culture, and there's many pictures that he took of the Ainus in their costuming and in their daily life, and it's a fascinating document of this ancient group of people who lived there. It was their country up there in the Northern Ireland, you know, for generations, for hundreds of years. And they were pushed aside by the Japanese who came in. Mm. It's a similar story to our Wild West. It's the Wild West of Japan, you might say, that he was conquering. Mm. And he took these people with him, befriended especially a couple of them who went with him on his expeditions when he went around the into the wilderness, it was then, to explore the region. He needed their help. Mm.
Now, did his brother Harvey also go to Japan?
No. Okay. No, he didn't, no.
But he established a school here.
Well, he didn't establish it. The town was building it. And I found in some records that he was then on the school committee. And his brother Harvey Wheeler helped establish West Concord, which was not particularly built up. Harvey Wheeler established a harness factory in the very late 1800s, harnesses for horses and wagons and workhorses and that kind of thing, because those were the days before the automobiles. So he built his factory on the river in West Concord because he needed the water and a mill to get the water into the factory to clean and dress down the leather. And so he established this business in West Concord, and as time progressed, he wanted his workers to live nearby. I guess it was hard for them getting to work. So he built homes right across the street in West Concord. We have Cottage Lane, Cottage Street up there in the hill. And I think he built maybe 20, 30 houses. I never numbered them. And he didn't exploit his workers, he let them buy them on time, and you know, let them buy them and have them
the houses.
Yeah, so he established, in a sense, the original living homes in West Concord, mm-hmm. And then there was a huge mill. Maybe other people, if you interviewed them, speak of the Damondale Mill that was built later on. But that was a huge mill regarding fabrics and clothing and such. And so this harness factory went on up until, I don't know, maybe in the 20s. They still continued, but of course there wasn't demand for leather harnesses and things of that sort, so it finally ceased to be around 1918, closed down. And Harvey Wheeler, his son took over after the World War I when he came back, Berkeley Wheeler. that Berkeley being my husband's father. So he had a lot to do with, this all started, we were talking about the school. So I found out that he was on the school committee in around 1917, and somehow they named the school after him. He must have had a lot to do with having the school built, because he had a lot to do with his factory and the houses he built in West Concord. Today they do not name any school after a living person. That's a firm policy in town, I know. But this one somehow snuck by before that. Yeah.
Well, he sounds like a real visionary, a real
social
and educational planner.
Mm-hmm. I think the two of them had a little competition there going. We all kind of think that, you know, because Harvey Wheeler, we discovered when we were having the William Wheeler forums that one of the famous landmarks in Hokkaido, Japan, in Sapporo, excuse me, that's the capital city of the island of Hokkaido, one of the main things that's on the tourist attraction is this clock tower, which is in a building that Wheeler, he was also an architect of sorts. This is the William Wheeler in Japan. He built this armory and a clock tower in it. And when you go to Sapporo, the clock tower is the symbol of the city. It's all over everything. It's on the buses. It's on the brochures. It's everywhere. And
an iconic tower.
Yes. When I was lucky enough to get there, the first thing that greeted me from at the airport was a bus going into the city, and there was this symbol of the clock tower, and I knew what I was looking at, and nobody else did, so I had to go over and hug it. I hope nobody was looking, but
oh.
I did. And so we were looking at that, and then you look up at the Harvey Wheeler, there's a clock tower there too, just about the same kind of structure. And I think that his brother Harvey, who stayed home in Concord, his nose was a little out of joint. And he built this clock tower in the new Harvey Wheeler School. Oh, that's probably why they named it after him. He knew that there was no clock. Every New England town needed a clock. You know, it's traditional. The clock would chime the hour, and you knew what time it was. This is going back to colonial times. Like Concord has the clock in the First Parish Church Tower. So he thought that West Concord ought to have a clock and a tower, too. So he built it inside the school, this clock tower, and he got the works from Waltham Clock Works. And I think that's really why they named the school after him, because he supported this whole project within the school for the town of West Concord. When they finally put up a school, they put up a clock tower because there's no church that had one there. So that's a little rivalry, I think, between the two of them. We never know. But it is interesting. It makes sense. Yeah.
So then your husband's father, he took up the business after 1918 when the harness began to... to go out of style.
Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Harvey had one brother, David. Harvey, my husband, had one brother, David, who recalled. I found a piece of paper among their things after they passed away, regarding a letter from the government just before World War II, somewhere in there, asking them to make some special harnesses out of buffalo hide. And I had never heard this story before. So that was one of the last things they did. They made harnesses out of buffalo hide because it could be used underwater for underwater surveillance, like divers and such. And so they made these special things around the time of of early in the 40s sometime. And then it closed down, the harness factory. But that was an interesting thing to find out about, because the government solicited them to do this special work on some kind of with leather from buffalo hide, which they'd never done before. And somehow they got found out and selected to do this special harnesses, yeah.
People who knew leather.
Mm-hmm. Harvey Wheeler employed prisoners from Boston. This is in the early 1900s. So his early workers were prisoners from Boston, ex-prisoners, because they knew the trade. And he found these people, and they helped him establish the business. Mm-hmm.
They had taken up leather work
in the prisons, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Early on.
Can you say that? I said it for you. The prisoners had...
The prisoners knew the trade of leather work. Yeah. And somehow he found that out, and I think they were his early employees that helped set up the business.
So your husband then, Harvey, must have been just a boy when all that was.
Yes.
He was born in.
He was born in 26.
Who's this?
My husband Harvey. Yeah. Yeah. So he was older than I am. I had three children. And I'm still here. Yeah. Did you want to know what kinds of things about the history of Concord kind of thing and from days gone by?
You've been great on that already. And so we're interested in all those things, but we're also interested in what it was like to raise three children here.
It's a lovely town to raise three children. It couldn't be easier, because it's as you know, a lovely community, and it's safe, and the school system is excellent, and you can pretty much walk everywhere and bike everywhere when the children were young. Yeah. And but the traffic has not improved. I don't think today it would be as safe as it used to be to let your kid out on a bike. I know it isn't. Yeah. The town's become a throughway for an awful lot of traffic, which is distressing to see. It was hard to find a place to park to come in here today, for instance. Yeah. But we lived up on the hill behind the Alcott House. And it was nice being that close to the town and close to the school, and everything was very convenient. And both our grandparents lived here, so they were handy across town to get to.
Your Wheeler grandparents?
The Wheeler grandparents,
you
yes.
Had, you had Wheelers on both sides.
I had, yes. Well, the one on my other side was back quite a ways. I won't go into that. Yeah. Genealogy. Yeah. It takes a genealogy wheel to show it to you accurately, but it's there. It's there.
You came here at the age of 21 from Winchester.
Yes.
Now,
yes, I did.
How would you compare Winchester with Concord? You had a chance to get to know Winchester pretty well, didn't you?
Yes, I grew up there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I grew up and I went to the school there through freshman year in high school, and then I went away to a boarding school. So I missed those big years there because I was away from town, but growing up there was, I guess it was sort of like what I experienced here in Concord, but that town was getting bigger and bigger, and that's one of the reasons my father wanted to leave, because it wasn't what he knew when he grew up there. You know, it got crowded, and all the surroundings that he knew as a boy were fields were all filled with houses in rows and rows of houses and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So he moved west to Concord. Yeah. He also moved out here because he had a factory in Somerville, and the Somerville factory he gave up and found a place in Lexington. So he didn't have to commute anymore. He could be in Concord and just go over to Lexington. He just thought that was wonderful, which if you've ever had a big commute, you'd agree with that.
Mm-hmm. And but he built a factory, you say, in Lexington?
Well, he moved the factory from Somerville, Mass. Out to Lexington, yes. Mm-hmm. It was Crowell Tube Company, it was called. Crowell, that was my maiden name, C-R-O-W-E-L-L, Crowell.
Mm-hmm. Tube, T-U-B-E.
T-U-B-E,
mm-hmm. Tubes.
Tubes, he made tubes. Big tubes and little tubes. They extracted them on these long benches out to tiny little tubes that are almost good. They'd be good enough for hypodermic needle tubes, so to speak.
Glass tubes.
No, all metal. No, he worked in metal only. Mm-hmm. Only. Mm-hmm. But that's not very Concord related. So he came here from Winchester. What did I say? 1954.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Crowell.
Mr. Donald Crowell.
Mr. Donald Crowell.
My parents were Donald and Doris Crowell. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how many of younger Crowells?
Oh, I just had one sister. One sister, Anne. Mm-hmm. And she just recently passed away. But there were only the two of us growing up together, two girls. So I had somebody to giggle with, so to speak.
Was she younger or older?
She's older, yeah. She's considerably older. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So as a mother, were you devoted entirely to your children, or did you develop any interests outside of home, or working with different committees,
Yeah, all of that. I seemed to be always active in other things beside the children. Mm-hmm. I would be active in community affairs. I've always been active in my church, always, continually active with the women's groups and with the worship groups and community education kind of things. And
community education?
Well, it was a group in Boston that I won't go into that. Let me see now. I think as the years moved on, women had more place in the community, and then, you know, they got into working, and I felt, you know, what am I want to have some place in this world that I can say I've done, and what would that be? I didn't care for stenography kind of a thing, which my sister was very good at. She was a graduate of Catherine Gibbs School of secretarial school, but I was more keen on the arts, and I've been a watercolor painter all my life, and I've been on art committees of all sorts in the church and in the community, And I began to arrange flowers for church because nobody was doing it, and what was up there looked terrible. And one thing led to another, and I became very good at it because I was in the garden club here, and we had some training in that. And a friend of mine asked me, "Oh, I like what you've done. Would you do my daughter's wedding?" Oh, golly, I thought about that, and I said, "Well, sure, why not?" So one thing led to another, and by golly, I had a flower business, arranging flowers, and it just suited me perfectly. You know, all the composition and the color and putting all your arts and training and your visual things together. So I began to do weddings and events with flower arranging, and I found my niche. It was delightful, and then they got paid for it too a little bit. I never made a lot of money, but as I say, it paid for itself, and I did it mostly in my own church because there's a lot of events there. Mm-hmm. And
you mentioned artistic training.
Oh yes, I forgot about that. Well, I did go to an art school in Boston, Vesper George School of Art, after I graduated from college. Mm-hmm. I went to the Vesper George School of Art, and we had particularly training in watercolor painting and in perspective for clients, and training for painting, for sketching and things for newspapers, you know, the early newspapers before photography took over. There was a lot of black and white sketches in there of rooms and fashion design and all kinds of things. But, of course, as soon as I got out of school, photography took over, and that was not used. No. But it was all there. I had it all. It was all there in my brain. And that was in the... When was that? Well, that was in the early 50s. Mm-hmm. But it was good training. It stays with you throughout life, that kind of training.
This was a couple of years you spent at the art school?
Yes. It was called Vesper George School of Art on St. Patel Street in Boston, Mass. So it was a great opportunity to be in Boston and learn the ins and outs of the city and the marketing and so forth. Mm-hmm. It was a great window on the world after college. It was fun. Mm-hmm. Great fun.
So interest in the city. Gardening, flowers, and flower art. Mm-hmm. Does this have roots in your upbringing at all? Is this something interest of your mother's or grandmother's?
Yes, you might say that. Yes, my mother... was a tremendous gardener, and
her
I could Doris Crowell. Mm-hmm. I was always out there gardening with her and raking and weeding, and since I can remember as a child. And during the war, we had a huge victory garden.
And Victory garden.
Victory garden. Well, that's what it was called in the war. Victory garden. Gardening was patriotic, to grow your own vegetables, because transporting them and growing them, things were in short supply. It was a war. That things went out to the troops first, not to the home front. So, and this was in Winchester. We had an enormous garden. And so I learned the vegetable garden. Always had one myself with the family. Put things up, canned things. And then, of course, freezing came along. That was much easier. And that's been a part of family life, is having a garden out back where you grow your own supplies.
Mm-hmm. And flowers.
And flowers. Mm-hmm. But I noticed that when my children are looking for property to buy, they also look at a place for the garden to grow vegetables, that is, particularly. Mm-hmm.
So as
well as flowers.
They picked up on as well.
Oh yes, it's sort of been a nice legacy, I guess, that grew from our being as a family together, gardening. Mm-hmm. through a couple of years there. We had a house on Cape Cod, and I know that for at least two falls we had our own little harvest dinner, and we're very proud of everything at the table we grew or caught, except for the milk in the glass, because we caught fish and brought it home and grew potatoes and vegetables and all the rest. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Nice tradition.
It was, yeah. I hadn't thought about it. Thank you for bringing it up. It was just one of those things that was always there with the family. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then when I moved to Concord, you find out, of course, this is a great tradition of the Wheelers in the farming. Wheelers farming is what built up this community from the early settlers' days of the 1600s. The Wheeler family is known for their farming.
Mm-hmm. And that's reflected in your own artwork?
Artwork.
I
do some farming.
Landscape
to the painting, yes. I go down to Verrill Farm, which is the old Wheeler farm, and it's called Verrill Farm, and they have a tent out there that looks over the farmland where people sit and buy food and eat it, and some of us sit there and paint, looking out over the farmlands. And come to think of it, I'm painting old Wheeler farmland, and I didn't realize that. But if you go to Nine Acre Corner, that's where the Wheeler farms were principally, mm-hmm. in Concord. Well, there wasn't industry out here in the 1600s, 1700s. Everybody had a farm. That's how you survived, really. Mm. It wasn't a city. It was farmland. Yeah.
Well, you were a very lovely and modest person, I am figuring out. So I want to ask you more about your artwork, because I have a feeling that it's not something you readily come forward with. I wonder where you've painted, where you've exhibited, how I could see some of your art.
Okay, well, after art school, we started in college too. We did things with watercolor, mostly architectural things, and renderings of interiors. I learned perspective and learned how to mix the colors. We were doing things in interiors. You had to tell the difference between an oak table or a mahogany table or a cherry table in little bitty increments of color. And so this color mixing, you kind of learned that way and by rote. So this kind of thing has stayed with me. I do watercolors with a workshop group once a week. We don't get there every week, but we still keep up with it. And it's a group that I've met with for many years. We do instructions, go to an instructor in the Concord Museum or other places, but we meet just to do our thing together without an instructor. So all of us say, oh, you know, at home you never get around to it. You're always at home and the phone rings or you're cooking something. So this gets you out of the house with your watercolors, and it keeps you going. It keeps your hand in it, and it's been a nice custom to have. So I've continued that.
And this is a weekly?
A weekly undertaking.
Is this your women's group you refer to?
It's a women's group. Mm-hmm. No, the women's group is something in church. That's another thing. But this is just, it is all ladies that meet to do watercolors. And we now gather at the Concord Museum, so we have an opportunity to see the exhibits, which, of course, keep you inspired. And lately I have moved to a condominium, and I have an entryway And it's funny you brought this up, because just a couple of months ago I decided I'm going to hang my own things out in the entryway as you enter. So I'm getting my own exhibition out there in the hall, because I have all these frame things I don't know what to do with that are stuck in a closet. So I've begun to go over some of my things, the best that are out there right now. And I do a more realistic kind of painting. I'd like to be freer and do things with greater speed, but I seem to still stick to the realism of getting a little more specific with my watercolors. And I do landscapes and some interiors, and I don't seem to do too many still lifes.
Portraits?
I did one portrait of my cat, who just died. So I have a portrait of my cat. Came out very well. I must say, I got to do more of them. Yeah. No, I don't do portraits otherwise. That's a whole nother difficulty. I could train in it, but I have not. No.
But Concord's a great place for painting landscapes.
Oh, indeed it is, yes. So this has been something I've been doing off and on all my life, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for bringing it up. It's just been something that's always undercurrent, that's there, that I take to now and then. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when the children were little, it was hard to get to it, but I've always gotten back to it again. And I like to do it with my grandchild, Katie, see if she takes to it. And my other grandchild is Adam.
How old are they?
Katie is a freshman in high school and is 14, and Adam is 21, I believe, in college at UNH. Mm-hmm.
So have you had them painting? Or?
Well, I did. Now, of course, they're of the age where they don't pay much attention to grandma or painting, but maybe it'll come around again. We'll see.
The seeds are sown.
I hope so. Mm-hmm. I hope so.
Mm. Well, this is just super fascinating. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm holding up. I don't know what other things you'd like to touch upon.
Well, you had mentioned 9 Acre Farm. Can you talk more about your experiences there? Some of the women who were around there, or older people?
Oh, well, 9 Acre Corner is where the Wheelers in the 1800s farmed. And I don't have any connection with it. What I was talking about is painting down there. And the family, the Verrill family that now owns the area, has a farm stand there and a bakery and a complete store. And that's where a lot of us go to buy beautiful produce, order my turkey there shortly for Thanksgiving, and they will make the pies and sides for your dinner. But they have a huge fields surrounding this store that they built. And it has pick your own strawberries, particularly pick your own raspberries, pick your own pumpkins, other than beautiful vegetables right directly taken out of the fields. Mm-hmm. And up on the hillside there is a Wheeler home, because the Wheelers originally started the land there in farming. But they're more distantly related to my side of the family. And yes, there is a Wheeler Road there, named after the area.
Might be fun to hear more generally about some of the women. We've heard about the grandfather, Harvey, and William. What were the women doing? Did they have wives, and what were their lives like?
Well, I've been able to find out very little about the women, frankly. They were not, they didn't have careers. They were wives that were domesticated, you know, domestic wives living in the homes and supporting the husbands. Back to William Wheeler, who went to Japan, we learned that just before he left, he became engaged. And he continued to correspond to his fiancée when he was in Japan, and they let him take leave from his duties there to come all the way home in the middle of his contract to get married. And their arrangement was that she'd be willing to go back to Japan with him, which she did. And so the last 2 years that he lived in Japan, he had Fanny, his wife, with him. And together they had many adventures that have been written up in correspondences, too. She was always by his side. Mm-hmm. And together, when they returned, he purchased a huge farm that was being sold, which was Neshottok Hill Farm, which is now quite a millionaire's community, I might say, of huge homes, because he kept the lots very large and built a big house there himself in 1879-ish, somewhere in there. So that's his story. What did I say her name was? Fanny, yes. Harvey Wheeler married Annie Bent from Needham, and we know very little about her. Mm-hmm. She had...
B-E-N-T?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess she was very quiet, unassuming, and she was supporting Harvey and all his community endeavors. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's unfortunate that we know so little about the women. Mm-hmm. I found for instance, my grandfather went on a trip to Europe on a boat, and we found the listing of the passengers, but not the mothers. They were not named, just that Donald was there with his mother. Poor girls. They were poor women. They were left out. Yeah.
But your church work is certainly involving women. Can you talk a little bit about your church and your work there?
Yes. I'm a member of the Women's Parish Association.
At
the First Parish in Concord, Unitarian Universalist Church. Oh, golly, it was formed here, and it's a church that has it was the first church in Concord, First Parish. And in those days, life revolved all around that church, and the Wheelers with it as well. And we're still there in force. The Women's Parish Association was formed in 1876 or so, I think. Again, that same year. Ellen Emerson was one of the founders of this group, and we continue today as a women's group in the church. Of course, men are now very welcome, and there are a few. But we meet monthly and supply the needs of the church, the kitchen, the parlor. We redo the furniture. We raise money through fairs and events in order to provide for specifics within the church. Curtains for the stage, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And we meet together and have a lot of camaraderie with our luncheons and events. And they've become sort of a second family to me because I've been with them for all the time I've been here. These women are wonderful women, and they're all very strong activists in the outer world as well, the outer community, for the environment, politically, for school committees. Some of them have been on the standing committee. There's a standing committee woman now. There's a woman in the parish, and on. It's a very strong, community-minded group. Mm-hmm. Women's Parish Association is back when I first came to town in the 50s, if you were a member of the church, you were automatically part of the Women's Parish group. That's where all the action was.
Did we interview the woman minister from?
Perhaps you did. Mm-hmm. Was it Jenny Rankin?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Well, she's been our minister. Mm-hmm.
She was terrific.
Oh, I know. Well, she's a tremendous educator and the Transcendental Movement. She's taken a great deal of leadership in that. Yeah, yeah.
She's no longer...
No, the minister of 27 years, Gary Smith, retired, and we now have a new minister. And she was part of the time with Gary Smith, and she's moved on as well. But she's teaching some transcendentalist class in the adult education center and
at the church.
At Concord Adult Ed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. She did the course at church when she was there, and I'm trying to think of the church she's moved to now. Well, it's not too far away. I don't want to say it. I don't want to guess. I can't grab it right now.
Probably good to hear more about changes in the church and in the area in general, but starting with the church, so that's a big change.
Yes, it is a big change, and it took a couple of years to find a suitable minister. Mm-hmm.
They had all been men previously in your lifetime?
Well, we've always had an assistant minister that's generally a woman, and of course we've had the religious education directors of women. We now have Howard Daner, and Marion Weisel is the assistant, and she's a woman. And what was the premise of your question? Was a
What are some of the major changes you're experiencing?
Well, growth, I think, is the biggest change, enormous growth in the church. And we have a very excellent religious education program, which has been grabbed by many parents. And it's grown to the point where they've had to get a lot of more staff to take care of all the children that have come into the program. I think there's some 440 there now, and all ages take part. And it's become a great spiritual community for the children's education. And Jenny Rankin had a lot to do with that, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so the growth has been something to adjust to. We went over to two services in order to accommodate all the growth. Yeah.
Two Sunday mornings.
Two Sunday mornings. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does it divide up in interesting ways?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And it's curious that you mentioned that, because we've just gone back to one, so that we're all one service. It got to be, oh, well, I haven't seen you for a while. What, do you come to the 10:30? You must come to the early one, you know, that sort of thing. There were sort of two groupies, the early service and the little later ones, where the moms and dads would come with their children, because it was hard to get them to Sunday school early. But now we're one great big happy family, and we all squish in together, and we love it, because it's universalist all together. And it's working out. We don't mind being a little more crowded, except Easter was a little tough, but that was all right. We worked it out. Now we'll have to work it out at Christmas. There'll be probably more services then to accommodate everybody. All those people who only come then, you know, and want to sing carols. Yeah.
So are the teachings of Ralph Waldo Emerson still kind of central to the theology?
Well, he's quoted often. He is quoted often. And I think
who
I hear
that?
Emerson is quoted often, in sermons and in readings. And so is in Henry David Thoreau. The Thoreau Society meets there annually, and we have a lot of parallels to his ideas on nature and
Well, is there anything else that you came desiring to talk about?
Well, I covered William Wheeler. That was sort of something that I didn't think too many people knew much about. So
yeah.
I liked to mention him. I had this article that I just pulled out of this box I have of a lot of articles and books and the photographs and such that I mentioned. I think there's a group that are coming right now from Japan, and they come every fall and every spring. A group comes from our sister city, Nanai, a group of students and teachers and the mayor. And they come and visit in Concord, and they have a lot of funding to bring their students here, but we don't have any at all in Concord, and it's too bad. We all have to scrounge around and have fundraisers and so forth to support some people to get there. So we don't have as big as exchanges we'd hope for. So I'm digressing again into William, but I'm trying to think of what other things I wanted to talk about. I don't know. I think we've covered an awful lot.
It's been fascinating.
I wonder if you had the two scenes side by side, 1950s and today in Concord, how would you compare and contrast them?
Well, the town the central part of the town has been preserved. I think the historic districts has had a lot to do with that. So as you drive around, you think, oh, this is just lovely, and aesthetically it's remained beautiful. There's not much more room for growth, and you see it when you go into the perimeters out in the countryside, the farmland that has been built up. And I was up Lawsbrook Road the other day, and I couldn't believe the growth there. Oh, says I, that's where all the smaller homes are, where all the kids come from. But you don't see that unless you explore in the back roads. The traffic, of course, is a horrendous problem. Getting through town just to get here sometimes can take me 10 or 15 minutes longer with the delays, just getting through the central area. And that never used to be. Everybody must have two or three cars. It depends. Maybe the middle of the morning when the rush hour is over, you do a little better. And I think the teardowns is brings a lot of distress. The house tear downs everywhere, big neighborhoods, little neighborhoods. A month ago, a friend of mine on Musketaquid Road, the house that I told you that the Wheelers purchased, built in the 50s, was just torn down. Oh, makes my heart beat, and I begin to shake just driving by looking at it. There it was gone. It was built in 54. It's gone. Several houses, there's one, two doors over that was a lovely home. That was demolished in 2 years ago. Rebuilt a lovely, huge place instead. Ugly, but there. And across the street, Jim Crockett, you've heard of the famous Mr. Jim Crockett, who's the Victory Garden man, who wrote this series of books on the Victory Garden. He was starred in the series in WGBH after Julia Childs did her series in cooking. Jim Crockett, who lived across the street from us on Musketaquid Road, did one in gardening. He built a house there in, around 1960. That was just demolished and rebuilt. I mean, what's going on?
And look what they're putting up in the places.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, these older structures were just fine. Mm-hmm. Of course, not up to code, I guess, anymore. I don't know. But people want something else, something fancier. And so down it comes. Hmm. So those are two changes, the traffic and the teardowns. But fortunately, the middle of the town is still lovely. And we miss the elm trees. They've come down. The elm trees. ELM. The elm trees that were...
The blight.
With the elm tree blight. Mm-hmm. They were everywhere.
Well, I'm glad you're exposing your grandchildren to your aesthetic generally and to your art specifically. That's encouraging to know that, as we said a while ago, that those seeds have been sown.
Oh, well, we hope so. We don't know yet. When they get in high school, they pick up different interests, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
All right. You're welcome. It's been better than I expected, I guess, when you say that. Yeah.
Okay, we're back on and picking up an important piece, activity of yours.
This is Barbara Wheeler, and discovered that... I've been singing all my life and somehow left that out of this the repertoire, we'll call it, because repertoire is what music is. I started in boarding school. I realized that I had a good voice that stayed on tune, and I had my first a cappella experience in the nativity play when four of us had to sing Aloha, a Roselle Blooming, and we were wonderful, and I had the bass, and I had a very low voice, and I've discovered that I held the bottom of all those wonderful chords. My mother had a very low voice. They called her Tallulah on the telephone. They said, yes, sir, to her. They thought she was a man. She had a very low voice. My speaking voice isn't low like that, but my singing voice is. So I was always got in a choir in school and college, and then when I was at home, I was in a church choir, and I've always been in a church choir until recently, and decided that it was time to retire. But and then there was the Concord Chorus, which does big programs annually, and that was my night out always when the children were young and Harvey would stay home with the kids. But somewhere in the 50s, the Sweet Adelines came into town. A group was formed called the Wayside Chapter locally, and they were looking for people. And I just thought that was right on for me. So I joined this, it was called the Sweet Adelines, the Women's Barbershop Choir, and then we had quartets and double quartets. We sang all over the place in nursing homes and malls and hospitals and so forth. But we went on the stage, and we were trained to be entertainers, and we had flashy costumes. And after a couple of years, we won in the region of New England out of 28 choruses. And we went on to the national stage down in San Diego, and we did pretty well. We weren't first, we were 18th, but we thought that was pretty good out of a new group, out of the first time coming to internationals. So I've enjoyed singing bass all my life. Amen.
I just have to hear about the flashy costumes.
Oh, well, in the Sweet Adelines, showmanship is a lot to do with being on stage. The choruses are 90, 30, 50. We got up to about 65 of us. We thought we were awfully good, and we were. And, of course, you had to all have a costume and dress alike in some manner. So you had a costume with a lot of sequins on it. That was the flashy part. And you had choreography, so you'd flash your skirt so the sequins would show at a certain point in the song that you had for competition. You had a very upbeat song, which had a lot of choreography, and then you had a more serious song. So you showed off all types of the music, you know, from soft to loud to flashy. Energetic, I should say.
So somewhere there were some serious numbers and mm-hmm. some.
You had two. You had a choice. You didn't have a choice. You had to do the two, an upbeat and a, I wouldn't say downbeat, but a more serious song.
Mm-hmm. And did somebody locally make the costumes, or a few?
Yes. And then we had to, some of us made our own. I sewed together some pieces, but somebody did the pattern, did the majority of it. But you had to sew on all the trim and the sequins yourself, because that was time-consuming. I was glad to get out of that, because it was a little too, got a little too, you know, to wear all the costumes that were done competitively.
But you did it for several years?
Mm-hmm.
While your kids were young?
Mm-hmm. No, this was after they had gone on to college.
Mm-hmm. Good for you. I bet they were impressed.
Well, it was good for me, because I never was a stage person. I could never get up on the stage and do acting. I was always the backstage helper, you know, the person doing the scenery and painting the scenery and bringing on the props. So that was a big deal for me, to get me up on a stage. But I had a lot of support. When there are 60 of you, it's fine.
Yeah. What a wonderful image.
Well, it brought singing to new heights, and I had this very low voice. I can sing bass with the men without any problem. So they needed a few really deep voices to carry the chords in the harmony for barbershop. So I was there for that.
Well, okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.